Welcome to the African American Hour. I'm Byron Buckner with 60 minutes of news, information, and commentary about the black community. This week, I have six readings. From the Guardian newspaper, I have a story about coping with the loss of a baby. I have an obituary from the New York Times about the passing of one of the last living Tuskegee Airmen. There's a story about the history of the word woke from the Independent newspaper. I'll be reading news about the death of a political refugee in Cuba from the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper. I'm going to wrap up the program with book reviews that focus on pioneering tennis player Althea Gibson from the New York Review of Books. And I'm starting with this from the newspaper, the San Diego Voice and Viewpoint, and its sdvoice.info website. The title of this article is McKenzie Scott Gives $70 Million to United Negro College Fund to Financially Strengthen HBCUs. This was written October 7, 2025, by Glenn Gamboa. Billionaire philanthropist McKenzie Scott has donated $70 million to the United Negro College Fund as the nation's largest private provider of scholarships to minority students works to raise $1 billion to strengthen all 37 of its historically black colleges and universities. The gift is one of Scott's largest single donations ever and among the first to be publicly disclosed in 2025. Famously private, Scott only discusses her donations through her website and does not confirm them until after the recipients do. This extraordinary gift is a powerful vote of confidence in HBCUs and in the work of UNCF, the nonprofit's president and CEO, Dr. Michael Lomax, told the Associated Press in a statement. It provides a once-in-a-generation opportunity for our member institutions to build permanent assets that will support students and campuses for decades to come. Dr. Michael Lomax said Scott's donation would be used for UNCF's pooled endowment, which aims to establish a $370 million fund, $10 million for each UNCF member HBCU. That fund will be invested and designed to pay out about 4% annually, which will then be divided among the HBCUs to help stabilize their budgets. Increasing HBCU endowments is a priority since they trail endowments at non-HBCUs by 70%, according to the United Negro College Fund. The broader $1 billion fundraising effort is an attempt to help HBCUs address the funding disparity they face when compared to other colleges and universities. A 2023 study by philanthropic research group Candid and ABFE, a nonprofit that advocates for investments in black communities, found that the eight Ivy League schools receive $5.5 billion from the largest U.S. foundations compared to $45 million for the 99 HBCUs in 2019. Since Scott, a novelist who received the bulk of her fortune after divorcing Amazon founder Jeff Bezos, signed the Giving Pledge in 2019, promising to donate more than half her wealth, HBCUs have been among her favorite grantees. She previously gave UNCF $10 million in 2020. Though Scott hasn't addressed HBCU donations specifically, she wrote in 2020 that her funding decisions were driven by a deep belief in the value different backgrounds bring to problem solving on any issue. Scott hasn't made any announcements about her giving since she acknowledged $2 billion in gifts in 2024, bringing her total to $19.2 billion. According to Forbes, Scott's net worth is currently around $34 billion. Her unusual donations, which are much larger than most foundations give at one time and carry no restrictions on when they can be used or what they can be used for, financially strengthen the nonprofits that receive them, said Phil Buchanan, president of the Center for Effective Philanthropy, which studied Scott's giving over 3 years. We didn't see the fears people predicted come to pass, said Buchanan, who disclosed that the Center for Effective Philanthropy received a one-time $10 million grant from Scott. Though some worried that the large gifts would cause the recipients to increase staffing too much or hurt their fundraising efforts, Buchanan said their study of 2,000 nonprofits saw little evidence of that. Folks are pretty prudent, he said. This shows that if you carefully vet nonprofits, you can trust them to make good use of funds. It's a lesson that UNCF hopes other fundraisers will learn following Scott's example. We are deeply grateful for Mackenzie Scott's continued support, Lomax said. By entrusting UNCF to decide how best to use these funds, she affirms that HBCUs merit investment at this scale, and her generosity will strengthen our member institutions and provide pathways to success for tomorrow's changemakers. That was the article. Mackenzie Scott gives $70 million to the United Negro College Fund to financially strengthen historically black colleges and universities. This was published October 7, 2025. It was written by Glenn Gamboa, and it was published in the San Diego Voice and Viewpoint newspaper. My next reading is titled, How Woke Went from an Expression in Black Culture to a Conservative Criticism. This was written by Terry Tang and published Tuesday, September 30th, 2025 in the Independent newspaper. The expression, stay woke, started out as an affirmation for African Americans. In the past decade, it has been used by some Republicans and some Democrats as a pejorative for people thought to be too politically correct, another term that took on negative connotations as it gained wider use. Woke has come up in cultural and political firestorms. 8 months into his second term, President Donald Trump pledged to review content at the Smithsonian Institution for being woke, and where everything discussed is how terrible our country is and how bad slavery was. At the beginning of this year, Texas Governor Greg Abbott declared in his State of the State address that government would keep woke agendas out of universities and K-12 schools, including woke gender ideologies. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said he was ending the woke culture in the military, saying that the service has been hamstrung by political correctness. He referenced diversity efforts, transgender troops, environmental policies, and other disciplinary rules. America is no longer woke under President Trump's leadership. The word woke represents radical ideologies that are used to divide the American people and harm our country, Liz Huston, a White House spokesperson, said in a statement. Here's where woke came from and how its meaning has evolved. Wokeness originated decades ago as African American cultural slang for having awareness and enlightenment around racism, injustice, privilege, or threats of white supremacist violence. Several historians trace the idea to a 1923 compilation of speeches and articles by Jamaican-born black nationalist Marcus Garvey. In one essay, Garvey writes, "Wake up, Ethiopia. Wake up, Africa." Another reference appears in 1938 in the song Scottsboro Boys by blues artist Leadbelly, whose real name was Huddy Ledbetter. The tune follows the true story of four black youths unjustly convicted by an all-white jury of the rape of two white women. They were later freed. The lyrics warn black listeners to be careful and stay woke. Keep your eyes open. Gerald McWhorter, a professor emeritus of African American Studies and of Information Sciences at University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, says, woke was about having a voice after hundreds of years of black suffering going back to the African slave trade. The phrase also popped up in a 1962 essay by novelist William Melvin Kelly for the New York Times. The headline, "If you're woke, you dig it." Kelly's widow and daughter believe he heard the term while walking around their Harlem neighborhood, said Elijah Watson, a pop culture writer and editor who has written about Kelly, who died in 2017. In the 21st century, singer-songwriter Erykah Badu, spelled E-R-Y-K-A-H, capital B-A-D-U, is often credited with reviving the term woke. Her song, Master Teacher, in her 2008 album, New America, Part 1, America is spelled capital A-M-E-R-Y-K-A-H. includes the refrain, "I Stay Woke." Badu picked up the phrase from co-writer and producer Georgia Ann Muldrow, who heard it from a saxophone player she collaborated with, Lakeisha Benjamin. The 2014 fatal shooting by a white police officer of 18-year-old Michael Brown, who was black and unarmed in Ferguson, Missouri, made woke and stay woke galvanizing pledges in the growing Black Lives Matter movement. The movement drew support from other racial groups. Woke also became popularized by white liberals who wanted to show they were allies. The backlash against woke and wokeness bubbled up in the 2010s amid discussions about including more black history in American history lessons. Many people said that bringing critical race theory to schools was meant to program children to feel guilty for being white. This argument became front and center in 2022 when Florida Governor Ron DeSantis signed the Stop Woke Act into law. It banned teaching or business practices on race and gender. The law is now on hold after a federal judge deemed it unconstitutional. For George Pearson, the former chair of the Illinois Black Republican Coalition, woke is a hollow word. Democratic politicians who purport to be champions of wokeness and DEI have done little for black people, he said. So woke has no sway as a rallying cry. He also thinks it's unfair that those who do not support wokeism are told, "You're racist, you're a homophobe, you're a bigot." Even among liberal black Americans, there is a debate whether the intention of woke does more harm than good. In Watson's experience, woke is no longer part of black vernacular. If he hears it from anyone in his social circles, it's almost always said in jest. Some progressives are trying to take the word back. Academy Award-winning actor and activist Jane Fonda brought up being woke while receiving the Screen Actors Guild Lifetime Achievement Award in front of an A-list audience. Make no mistake, empathy is not weak or woke. By the way, woke just means you give a damn about other people, Fonda said. Sina Hodges started her own business as a DEI strategist for individuals and groups in 2018 and called it the Woke Coach. She and her team consult on everything from workplace interactions to best recruiting practices. She touches on inclusion for groups from people of color to breastfeeding mothers. The bastardization of woke and DEI as words akin to slurs doesn't bother her, she said. To her, at its core, being woke is about awareness. What it really boils down to is helping people develop a more acute level of emotional intelligence, she said. That was the article, How Woke Went from an Expression in Black Culture to a Conservative Criticism. This was written by Terry Tang and published September 30th, 2025 in the Independent newspaper. My next reading is titled, Assata Shakur, Black Liberation Icon and U.S. Fugitive Dies in Cuba at 78. This was published in the Baltimore Afro-Americans Afro.com website on September 26, 2025, and was written by Philip Marcello. Assata Shakur, a black liberation activist who was given political asylum in Cuba after her 1979 escape from a U.S. prison where she had been serving a life sentence for killing a police officer, has died, her daughter and the Cuban government said. Shakur, who was born Joanne Deborah Chesimard, died September 25th in the capital city of Havana due to health conditions and advanced age, Cuba's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said in a statement. Shakur's daughter, Kakua Shakur, confirmed her mother's death in a Facebook post. A member of the Black Panther Party and Black Liberation Army, Shakur had long been emblematic of the fraught relations between the United States and Cuba. American authorities, including President Donald Trump during his first term, had demanded her return from the communist nation for decades. The FBI put Shakur on its list of most wanted terrorists. But in her telling, and in the minds of her supporters, she was pursued for crimes she didn't commit or that were justified. Shakur and two others were involved in a gunfight with New Jersey State Police troopers following a highway traffic stop on May 2, 1973. Trooper Werner Forrester was killed and another officer was wounded, while one of Shakur's companions was also killed. Shakur, who was at the time wanted on several felonies, including bank robbery, fled but was eventually apprehended. The New York City native was found guilty in 1977 of murder, armed robbery, and other crimes, and was sentenced to life in prison, only to escape in November 1979. Members of the Black Liberation Army, posing as visitors, stormed the Clinton Correctional Facility for Women, took two guards hostage, and commandeered a prison van to break Shakur out. She disappeared before eventually emerging in 1984 in Cuba, where Fidel Castro granted her asylum, according to the FBI. Offering Shakur asylum was one of the most famous examples of Cuba aligning itself with what it describes as revolutionary forces struggling against the oppressive capitalist empire to the north. Much like Cuba supported anti-colonial and left-wing forces in Africa, Central, and South America, the Cuban government saw the armed Black liberation movement in the United States as part of a global revolutionary struggle. New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy and State Police Superintendent Patrick Callahan said they will vigorously oppose any attempt to repatriate Shakur's remains to the United States. Sumudiata Okoli, who was also convicted in Forrester's killing, was granted parole in 2022 after being in prison for nearly three decades. In her writings over the years, Shakur has maintained that she didn't shoot anyone and had her hands in the air when she was wounded during the gunfire. More recently, her writings became a rallying cry during the Black Lives Matter movement, though opponents criticized her words as being influenced by Marxist and communist ideology. "It is our duty to fight for our freedom. It is our duty to win," Shakur wrote in Asata, an autobiography, originally published in 1988. "We must love each other and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains." Black Lives Matter Grassroots Incorporated, a collective of racial justice activists from around the United States, paid tribute to Shakur on September 26. "May her courage, wisdom, and deep abiding love permeate through every dimension and guide us," the group said in a statement posted to Instagram. "May our work be righteous and brave as we fight in her honor and memory." Shakur's influence extended into the music world. She was famously close to the family of late rapper Tupac Shakur, who had considered her a godmother. Public Enemy, the political hip-hop group and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, are thought to be the first major artists to reference Shakur. The 1988 song Rebel Without a Pause, from the album It Takes a Nation of Millions to Hold Us Back, includes the lyrics "Supporter of Chesimard," referring to her legal name. Rapper Common told Shakur's story in his 2000 song, A Song for Asada. That was the Baltimore Afro-American newspaper story, Asada Shakur, Black Liberation Icon and U.S. Fugitive Dies in Cuba at 78. It was published September 26, 2025, and written by Philip Marcello. Next on today's African American Hour, an obituary. George Hardy, Tuskegee Airman who fought in three wars, dies at 100. This was published in the New York Times newspaper on September 28, 2025, and was written by Richard Goldstein. George Hardy, a retired Air Force Lieutenant Colonel who was one of the last surviving combat veterans of the Tuskegee Airmen, the all-black squadron in the segregated U.S. military during World War II, and who subsequently flew 45 missions in the Korean War and 70 in the Vietnam War, died on Wednesday, September 24th, in Sarasota, Florida. He was 100. His death at his home was announced by the National Office of the Veterans Organization, Tuskegee Airmen Incorporated. Colonel Hardy, a Philadelphia, Pennsylvania native, was 19 and had never driven a car when he began aviation cadet training in September 1944 at Tuskegee Army Airfield in Alabama. By early the next year, in the closing months of the war in Europe, then Second Lieutenant Hardy was assigned to an Army Air Forces base in Italy, from which he flew 21 missions accompanying bombers to their targets over southern Germany in early 1945. In addition to those high-altitude missions in P-51 Mustang aircraft, he made strafing runs on German trains, trucks, or river barges and was once struck by small arms fire. He knew he was hit, he recalled, to the National World War II Museum in New Orleans when he saw a flash of light coming through the cockpit floor, which was usually dark. Colonel Hardy reflected on the camaraderie between black and white airmen during that period. When we get back to the base, we would get together and drink, he told the Tampa Tribune in 2012. They really appreciated us. But once we got back to the United States, we were reminded that things hadn't changed. When we walked down the gangway of the boat as it docked, there was a sign, whites to the right, coloreds to the left. After all we had been through, it really didn't feel too good. After a brief return to civilian life to study engineering, Colonel Hardy joined the newly formed Air Force in 1948, a year after the military was desegregated, and became a specialist in radar and long-range navigational equipment. Deployed to Okinawa, Japan, in 1950 during the Korean War, he was assigned to co-pilot B-29 bombers, but had conflicts with a racist colonel who did not want him in the cockpit. He remembered the colonel ordering him, "Hardy, get down out of the airplane," as he was readying for his first mission. That same plane, he said, was shot down over North Korea, and two of the airmen who bailed out were captured and died in a prison camp. Colonel Hardy, by then a first lieutenant, went on to have a distinguished run piloting B-29s. Back home, however, he continued to face indignities. During a stint in Fort Worth, he was refused housing on base, time, and a rise in ranks. He was promoted to lieutenant colonel in 1966, helped improve the situation, he said. Colonel Hardy spent years in supervisory roles involving the maintenance of electronic equipment before his final tour of duty in Vietnam, where he piloted an AC-119K gunship. His decorations included the Distinguished Flying Cross and 12 Air Medal Awards, recognizing single acts of extraordinary achievement or heroism. He later worked in program management for the GTE Corporation in Massachusetts for more than 15 years. He also traveled throughout the United States, telling the story of the Tuskegee Airmen's fight against racial prejudice, their combat exploits, and their military and civilian careers that followed. Flying, he told the Florida newspaper, the Bradenton Herald, in 2005, made a better life for me. George Edward Hardy, the second oldest of seven children, was born on June 8, 1925, in Philadelphia. His father, Edward Hardy, was a podiatrist, and his mother, Alma Vargas Hardy, looked after the home. Excelling in math, George at first wanted to pursue a career in engineering, but after he graduated from South Philadelphia High School in 1942, he thought he would follow his older brother into the Navy as a mess attendant, one of the few jobs open to black recruits in the rigidly segregated service. His father, however, wanted better for me than being a cook, Colonel Hardy said, and dissuaded him from signing up. By early 1943, the Army Air Forces were desperate for pilots and began accepting applicants as young as 17 with high school diplomas. George Hardy signed up and scored high on the exam for pilot training. As a young recruit, he had never been far from home and found the trip south was an awakening. The Pullman ride out of Philadelphia was wonderful, he told the Tampa Tribune. But when we changed trains in Cincinnati, we found that when we went to eat, we had to sit at a table divided by a thick curtain, with whites on one side and blacks on the other. I used to say the Army's number one job was segregation, he added. Winning the war was number two. While in the military, he received a bachelor's degree in electrical engineering in 1957 and a master's degree in systems engineering in 1964, both from the U.S. Air Force's Institute of Technology at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base near Dayton, Ohio. Survivors include three children, Josephine, Paul, and Deborah Hardy, all from his marriage to Beatrice Good, which ended in divorce, two stepchildren, Kelly Ledoux Lee and Christopher Lott, seven grandchildren and three great-grandchildren. His second wife, Catherine Lott, who was known as Bonnie, died in 2008 after 28 years of marriage. Another son from his first marriage, Gerald, died in an automobile accident a few years ago, his family said. In 2024, the National World War II Museum presented the Tuskegee Airmen with the institution's highest honor for their accomplishments and patriotism in the face of discrimination. Accepting the award on behalf of the group, Colonel Hardy said, When I think about the fellows who flew before me and with me at Tuskegee, and the fact that we did prove that we could do anything that anyone else could do, and it's paid off today, it's hard to believe that I'm here receiving this award with them. That was the obituary. George Hardy, Tuskegee Airman who fought in three wars, dies at 100. This was written by Richard Goldstein and published September 29, 2025, in the New York Times newspaper. My next reading on today's African American Hour is titled, It's a Collective Validation, the Group Helping Black Families Cope After Baby Loss. This was written by Nisreen Malik and published October 1st, 2025, in the Guardian newspaper. When I first started chatting with Gina and Rachel, the founders of Ebony Bonds, I was braced for a painful conversation. Ebony Bonds, founded last year, supports black families in the United Kingdom through bereavement after baby loss. What unfolded was a conversation that was mostly about how to show your love. Rachel Burrell and Gina Reeves were inspired to found Baby Bonds after experiencing the loss of their babies in stillbirth and feeling unsupported and not listened to at hospitals and by other care providers. Unable to find the specific tailored resources for support within conventional charities, the duo began with what they thought would be a small gathering. In 2023, they put out the word for a walk and talk for black parents with similar experiences and were stunned by the turnout. More than 70 people showed up, including friends and extended families of parents. They all walked for miles together along the River Thames, then ate at a Caribbean restaurant. We didn't expect the turnout, Rachel tells me, and we didn't expect people to say consistently, when is the next one? As they surveyed the numbers of people chatting and dining, Gina said to Rachel, this is pretty big, to which Rachel replied, it's needed. It's needed. The demand was there because the support was not. Families just never had a space before to express their loss freely, without judgment, without being moved on, Rachel says. Most importantly, Gina and Rachel noticed similarities in people's stories and how similarly black people are being treated. For a lot of women in particular, their help was validation that they haven't been going crazy. It wasn't just them that felt the doctors were off, or the sonographers weren't paying attention to them, or the nurses weren't listening. The group conversations were a collective validation that this was happening to us disproportionately. Those feelings reflect the reality for black parents. In England and Wales, black babies are still born at almost double the rate of white babies. And black women in the United Kingdom have drastically poor maternal health outcomes compared to their white counterparts. While we spoke, my own recollections of dismissive hospital treatment in the UK began to tingle. When I shared some of them with Gina and Rachel, there was again that validation. Rachel describes these experiences as repetitive. The leading factor, she says, is that you're not being listened to. I asked the two founders about how they help wider families and friend groups to help parents. It's such a stigma where we don't talk about these things, Gina says. We find it difficult within the Caribbean and African community. But what is most helpful is the most simple, she notes. You just need to regularly check in. Rachel believes that black families are well positioned to be supportive, despite the stigmas around not telling people your business. We have conversations with grandparents who see their children in pain and don't understand how to cope with that. But as a community, we are very proactive, she says, in how to nurture, especially with our women. She says that the key is to just support someone the same way you would support as if anything else happened to them. Bring food, fill up the house, muck in. Just don't act like it hasn't happened, that's all. You don't always have to have the answers. There is a tendency to bury uncomfortable conversations under the carpet or ask people to pray. Our thing at Ebony Bonds, Rachel explains, it's always to acknowledge that baby and those parents and say, I'm really sorry that happened to you. What hit home in our conversation is that, along with the upset at the failure of health institutions and support resources, there was also a matter-of-fact acknowledgement that these services just don't have the skills to help people who don't fit the mainstream mold. Cultural differences, religion, How families react to trauma are all things Black people do not have to explain to us, Rachel says. It means we are providing a space for families to be themselves. That need to be yourself means that Gina and Rachel's work has extended, like a warm halo. Gina tells me her husband, Peter, started a group that supports Black men who have experienced loss and other traumas. It's called NINE, which stands for The Nod Is Not Enough, in reference to the male tendency to simply nod instead of engage when they have a problem. Gina's pride in Peter overflows and she brings him into our call. I've just had the phone thrown at me, Peter says. NINE is not only for trauma. It's also about just being a Black man. He wanted to create a positive space where you know if you have a problem or a life difficulty, you can reach out and someone will help you. Just be there, Peter tells men who get in touch asking how they can help loved ones. His advice is simple. Just go around. Spend the night. Cook, clean, bring your own family. When you look back, he explains, you realize how much that helped you, how much strength it gave you. What struck me as they spoke about themselves and the network of friends and family around those they support is how much love always surrounds the bereaved. People just need to understand how they can show it. That was the article, It's a Collective Validation, the group helping Black families cope after baby loss. This was written by Nazreen Malik and published October 1st, 2025, in the Guardian newspapers, theguardian.com website. I'm going to wrap up today's African American Hour with two book reviews about the late, great tennis player, Althea Gibson, who just happened to be my mother's physical education teacher at Lincoln University in Jefferson City, Missouri, back in the 1950s. The title of the books being reviewed are Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson by Ashley Brown, and Althea, The Life of Tennis Champion Althea Gibson, written by Sally H. Jacobs. The title of this review is called Ahead of the Game, written by Sasha Abramsky, and it was published in the New York Review of Books magazine on September 5th, 2025. Althea Gibson was a tall, strong, and exceptionally hard-hitting tennis player. Her serve was a rocket, her volleys forceful, aimed not at continuing a rally, but at putting an exclamation point at its end. In a lily-white sport dominated in mid-century America by middle-class athletes, with elite gatekeepers who went out of their way to put up obstacles in the paths of Black players, Gibson, a Black woman, was a whirlwind of energy and determination, shattering the color barrier at one marquee event after the next. In 1956, her breakthrough year, she won the French Championship, now the French Open, becoming the first Black player, male or female, to win a Grand Slam. Over the next few years, she established herself as one of the game's best players. She won both Wimbledon and the U.S. Nationals, now the U.S. Open, in 1957 and 1958. New York City fed it to her with a ticker tape parade. And yet, her achievements in the decades that followed have been largely forgotten. Her post-tennis forays into singing and saxophone playing, her bit part in a John Wayne movie, her failed business ventures, her series of appointments to athletics boards in New Jersey, all were ineffectual codas to her extraordinary athletic story. Gibson's two memoirs, one published in the late 1950s, the other a decade later, sold far more modestly than later best-selling memoirs by Billie Jean King and Andre Agassi. They weren't enough to keep her in the tennis world's consciousness, let alone in the broader public eye. Like so many other champions who played before the Open era, which began in 1968 when Grand Slam tournaments allowed professionals to play alongside amateurs, paving the way for superstars to rake in tens of millions of dollars in winnings and endorsements, Gibson became something of a footnote. Two recent biographies of Gibson seek to redress that historical wrong. Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson by the University of Wisconsin sports historian Ashley Brown, and Althea, The Life of Tennis Champion Althea Gibson by the former Boston Globe reporter Sally Jacobs, share an abundance of sources and cover much of the same ground. Both present Gibson's flourishing career against a backdrop of racial terror in the Deep South and the burgeoning civil rights movement, and examine her reluctance to be seen as the Jackie Robinson of tennis. Gibson was staunchly apolitical, at least while she was center stage in the sports world. She repeatedly told friends and mentors that she hoped to be judged solely on her merits and not as a part of a larger cause or as a representative of a larger group. In her first memoir, I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, published in 1958, she wrote that Robinson thrived on his role as a Negro battling for equality, whereas I shy away from it. I shy away from it because it would be dishonest of me to pretend to have a feeling I don't possess. Gibson was born in 1927 in South Carolina, then raised in Harlem, on a street so ravaged by tuberculosis that it acquired the nickname the Lung Block. Her father was a sadistic, violent man who beat her frequently. Convinced that there was money to be made in the world of lady boxing, he encouraged her to learn the sport by taking her to the roof of their apartment building, punching her in the face, and forcing her to fight back. At times, the beatings, with fists and with whips, were so ferocious that in the early 1940s, Gibson sought refuge with various child protection agencies. During her adolescence, she ran with street gangs, got into fights, and wound up in trouble for shoplifting and other petty crimes. Her school attendance record was spotty at best, and she would often stay out late at pool halls drinking and smoking. It was clear very early that Gibson was a naturally gifted athlete. Like the late Victorian English athlete Lottie Dodd, who excelled at tennis, golf, field hockey, endurance cycling, ice skating, tobogganing, mountaineering, and archery, or the pre-war American athlete Babe Dietrichson Zaharias, who hit a mean baseball, was a champion track and field competitor, and won 17 consecutive golf tournaments, Gibson succeeded at whatever sport she turned her hand to. And like Dodd and Dietrichson, she was at least as happy competing against male stars as she was duking it out with other women. She was the New York City paddle tennis champion from 1938 to 1942, played on the city's men's softball team, hit baseballs and threw footballs with male athletes in her spare time, and later in life played professional golf. But what she became most renowned for, by virtue of her extraordinary skills, her drive, and the raw physicality of her court game, was tennis. Gibson knew how talented she was. A number of African-American promoters, coaches, and fellow athletes helped nurture her gifts in the hope that she would break color barriers. But she herself did not want to be reduced to a symbol or a cause. Color bar? I have never met it in tennis, Jacob quotes Gibson as telling the British press during her first trip to Wimbledon. For Gibson, this is an improbable claim made possible only by the tennis star dismissing the several years that she had been barred from white competition because of the color of her skin. Still, despite Gibson's reluctance to let skin tone define her athletic accomplishments, circumstances drew her into the political fray. However much she wanted to be known just as Althea Gibson, tennis player, to both her fans and her foes, she was always Althea Gibson, African-American tennis player. When she competed in tournaments around the country, especially in southern cities defined by segregationist politics, a swirl of racism followed in her wake. Cartoonists drew grotesque caricatures of her, and the hospitality industry made it clear that she wasn't welcome in local hotels and restaurants. Overseas, she was depicted either as a heroic portent of post-racial American future or as a grave threat to the powers that be. As Brown, who is African-American, puts it, race made Gibson a political paradox, a godsend, and kryptonite all at once. Gibson was the first African-American to participate in top-tier tennis tournaments like Wimbledon and the U.S. Nationals. After she had spent several years building a reputation for herself on the circuit, the State Department found it politically convenient to send her on a goodwill tour of Asia to refute Soviet arguments that the United States was incorrigibly racist. When she won major tournaments, Jet and Ebony published one flattering story after the next. The Chicago Defender, arguably the preeminent black-owned paper in the country, ran joyous articles predicting that she was destined for more success. After her Wimbledon triumph in 1957, it was black liberals in New York, along with some of their white allies, who campaigned for a ticker tape parade. She was, however, never an easy fit. At the height of her success, she pointedly did not speak out against Jim Crow, nor as personal indignities, such as not being allowed to stay in the same hotels as other players during tournaments in the South. Personally, I prefer to do my battling for racial equality by setting a good example as a professional and as a person, Gibson told a reporter for the San Francisco Examiner. Over time, as more radical black voices came to the fore in both sports and politics, many in the African American media who had previously lionized Gibson grew sharply critical. In 1965, years after Gibson had retired from amateur tennis, Sam Lacey described her in the Baltimore Afro-American as a successful, if somewhat aloof, representative of colored progress. As Gibson put it in I Always Wanted to Be Somebody, members of the Negro press beat my brains out regularly. Brown's biography offers strong cultural analysis, whereas Jacob's book has a better eye for detail. It is in Jacob's book that we hear the sounds of a hostile crowd in Paris heckling Gibson in 1956 as she fought to overcome her nerves and win her first Grand Slam final. Then the booing began, Jacobs writes, with panache. First a rogue voice here and there, and then a collective thrum percolating even higher into the stands. Althea, bewildered, looked around her as some among the 8,000 spectators began to jeer. Gibson's journey was never easy. After her father beat and terrorized her, she distanced herself from her family. In the late 1940s, largely estranged from her parents, though she would later renew her relationship with her mother, Gibson sought refuge on the streets, in the offices of child welfare agencies, and among friends she picked up through sports and on her nightly rambles around Harlem. She spent less and less time with her family, instead seeking out mentors and substitute parents wherever she could find them. The legendary boxer Sugar Ray Robinson met her at a bowling alley in the early part of the decade and noticed her athletic potential. He introduced her to various friends, who in turn put her in touch with the tennis coach, Fred Johnson. Johnson, a larger-than-life character with only one arm, cajoled some of his contacts to pony up rackets and other equipment for her. He got her admitted to the swanky Cosmopolitan Club, the nearest thing to a country club in Harlem. In her loneliness, she came to regard the abode of Sugar Ray and his wife, Edna May, as her home away from home. They reciprocated, fully welcoming her into their lives. She was championed, too, by a number of tennis coaches, musicians, and African-American society figures, including two Southern doctors. Robert W. Johnson, who ran a summer tennis camp at his home in Virginia for promising black athletes, among them, a decade later, a young Arthur Ashe, and Hubert A. Eaton, who was a tennis fanatic from North Carolina, and who saw in Gibson the possibility of the world's first African-American tennis superstar. Eaton and Johnson met her at the American Tennis Association tournament at Wilberforce University in Ohio, where they were scouting for new prospects. At a time when many African-Americans were migrating out of the Jim Crow South to the North, Gibson went the reverse route, moving from New York to North Carolina to complete her schooling and to Virginia during the summers to train with Johnson. Gibson finished high school in her early 20s. She was admitted to Florida Agricultural and Mechanical College on a sports scholarship, which she used as a launch pad to rack up an impressive string of victories in ATA tournaments around the country, becoming far and away the best female tennis player on the tour. Eaton and others held her up as the player who could at long last break the color barrier. Begrudgingly, several smaller tournaments in the United States opened their doors to her in the early 1950s. When she achieved impressive results, a campaign organized by ATA figures and a group of socially progressive white women players, including Alice Marble, once ranked number one in the world, finally won her admission to the world's premier championships, such as Wimbledon and the U.S. Nationals. For the first few years that she was entered into these draws, Gibson was talented enough to reach the latter rounds, but never quite good enough to win. True, she had an explosive serve, whipped her ground strokes past lesser opponents, and volleyed as aggressively as the top men on the circuit. She was cat-like fast, and she had a hunger to win. At the same time, she was driven by self-doubt, and in title matches could fall apart under pressure. For the first decade of her life at the top echelons of tennis, she was an also-ran, the sort of player who could on a good day do incredible things, but who seemed destined never to become the star of the show. But as she approached 30, in those days a ripe old age in the world of tennis, she got an opportunity for a do-over when she set off halfway around the world on the State Department-sponsored Goodwill Tour of Asia. At the back end of the trip, perhaps seeking distance from the glare of publicity that always followed her in America, she continued on an extended tour, which she funded herself, of North Africa and Europe. When she returned, she seemed more relaxed, as if she had conquered the psychological demons that had prevented her from realizing her potential. Extraordinary things followed. For 30 months, from the spring of 1956 and through the fall of 1958, she threw off that also-ran status and, at an age when many players were already far past their peak, in the 1950s, few tennis players continued to compete at a top level into their 30s, entered a league of her own. She won a huge number of singles, doubles, and mixed doubles tournaments, and at last triumphed in Paris, London, and New York. Billie Jean King, in her 1988 book, We Have Come a Long Way, The Story of Women's Tennis, described Gibson's swagger. She had gone from being a talented player who could let doubt creep in to having supreme confidence in her own abilities. The results were stunning. In those 2 years, King wrote, Gibson won everything she had ever wanted to win. The glow of success proved fleeting. After 2 years of dominating the amateur game, where players came away with glory but very little prize money, she attempted to make it as a professional. At the time, going pro meant chancing it that promoters could set you up with lucrative matches or group you with a few other players with whom you could travel from venue to venue on what was little more than a glorified entertainment circuit. Not until 1968, with the world's major tennis events finally opened their doors to professionals, and not until 1973, would Billie Jean King successfully organize women to demand equal pay at those crowd-drawing championships. As a woman going pro in 1959, Gibson was well ahead of the curve. The lucrative contracts that male players, such as the Australian superstar Rod Laver, were getting remained out of reach. She earned some money here and there, including for a time as a warm-up act for the Harlem Globetrotters. At one point, she made enough money to put down a payment on a large house in Queens. But, ultimately, she never found a way to make the sums that King and other white female stars did a decade later. And, over time, she lost most of the money she had accumulated. Along with a few other young women who wanted to tour as pros, she went from one city to the next, playing exhibition matches in venues ranging from Madison Square Garden in New York to sports arenas in Chicago and Los Angeles. For an athlete of her caliber, the routine must have been extremely dissatisfying. The promoters were more interested in what their players wore than in how they played. Then in southern cities like Dallas, Gibson was routinely denied access to basic amenities. She had to rely on her white friends' willingness to buy takeout food, which Gibson would then humiliatingly have to eat in the car. Gibson's post-tennis career was in many ways even more frustrating. She spent years honing her golf game. She had been fascinated by the sport for years and became a competent, though no means outstanding player on the LPGA Tour. Her yearly earnings were mediocre, often practically non-existent, and she spent much of her middle age working as an athletic commissioner, promoting sports in New Jersey on behalf of the state's government. None of her post-tennis jobs stuck for long. As her finances grew more precarious, her mental health declined. Gibson's low-profile post-tennis career was in part of her own making. It wasn't that she was a recluse. She loved the attention that came with success. But both Brown and Jacobs make clear she was unwilling to make the compromises necessary to secure the unadulterated praise of writers and fans or to keep her in the spotlight once she had laid down her racket. It is instructive to look at how a figure like author Ash, a decade after Gibson, took a different course. Ash went through the same Virginia Training Academy for up-and-coming black tennis players and also went on to win U.S. Open and Wimbledon titles. Although in his early years on the tour he wasn't politically active, as Raymond Arsenault writes in his 2018 biography, Author Ash a Life, later in his career, Ash began to relish his historic role as the first black man to win tennis's most sought-after trophies, positioning himself as a spokesperson for black athletes on an array of issues and writing a series of books detailing how politics percolated into his life as an athlete. Once he stopped competing, he took on a number of civil rights causes, becoming a campaigner in the United States around issues ranging from social conditions in the inner city to affirmative action, a vocal critic of South African apartheid, and a hugely effective advocate for people with HIV/AIDS. Ash spent years working to persuade the South African government to grant him a visa so that he would play in that country's Open. When at last he was allowed in, he made it all the way to the final, insisting that organizers allow black spectators into the stands and holding a series of impromptu tennis academies with local black youth. He was willing to get himself arrested on behalf of political causes he believed in. And once his tennis career was ended by a major heart attack, he put his energies into a series of public profile campaigns to shift public policy on a range of issues affecting black people in the U.S. and beyond. Gibson, by contrast, had frequently lambasted commentators and tennis promoters who tried to pigeonhole her as a black player. Only in retirement did she take a leaf from Ash's playbook and eventually lean further into her role as an African-American sporting pioneer. In 1997, Angela Buxton, one of Gibson's closest friends on the tennis circuit, met Richard Williams, the tennis-obsessed father of Venus and her younger sister Serena in Florida. Buxton was intrigued by Richard, driven by the belief that his daughters could become wealthy superstars from tennis. He had taught them to tough it out on the courts of deeply impoverished Compton, California, then moved the family east in the early 1990s so that the two young girls could attend a tennis training camp. The Williams family story was one Buxton knew would interest Gibson. She set up a phone call between Gibson and the teenage Venus. Gibson talked with Venus at length that day, giving her advice on how to approach her matches and how to engage with the crowd. Though they never met in person, when Venus won her first Grand Slam, Gibson sent her an ecstatic telegram. "I gladly pass the torch to you and Serena," she wrote. By then, Gibson was in her early 70s, had been in failing health for well over a decade, and, often exploited by the men in her life, was so short of funds that Buxton and others resorted to fundraising campaigns to get her enough money just to meet her daily needs. She drank too much, suffered several strokes, and was increasingly isolated from the broader world. At times she felt suicidal. The once dominant athlete, who stood 5'10" tall, now weighed barely 100 pounds. She pushed away even her closest friends, including Billie Jean King and David Dinkins, the former mayor of New York City. Gibson died in 2003 at the age of 76 after a series of heart attacks. The tributes to her were muted. Efforts to name a U.S. Open stadium after her stalled. The main stadium court was instead named after Ash, and the entire tennis annex that houses the tournament was named for King. Eventually, Gibson was acknowledged on the stadium's grounds with a statue. Almost despite herself, she had made the ongoing segregation of the world of tennis untenable. Notwithstanding her protestations that she was in it only for herself and not for a larger cause, she was an indispensable participant in the democratization of the sporting world. That was the book review titled Ahead of the Game, written by Sasha Abramski. It was published in the New York Review of Books magazine on September 25, 2025. It reviewed two books about Althea Gibson, Serving Herself, The Life and Times of Althea Gibson, written by Ashley Brown, and Althea, The Life of Tennis Champion Althea Gibson by Sally Jacobs. That's all the time we have this week. If you would like to replay this program or past editions of the African American Hour, you can find them wherever you get your podcast or in the Audio Reader archives at reader.ku.edu. I'm Byron Buckner, and thank you for listening to the African American Hour.